This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Police detained over 1,500 people and used force to break up rallies around Russia on Saturday as tens of thousands of protesters demanded the release of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Navalny had called on his supporters to protest after being arrested last weekend as he returned to Russia from Germany for the first time since being poisoned with a Soviet-era nerve agent. The authorities had warned people to stay away from Saturday's protests, saying they risk catching COVID-19 as well as prosecution and possible jail time for attending an unauthorized event. But protesters defied the ban and bitter cold and turned out in force. A protest monitoring group said that at least 1,600 people, including more than 500 in Moscow and more than 200 in St. Petersburg, had been detained across Russia. It reported arrests at rallies in nearly 70 towns and cities. Navalny is in a Moscow prison pending the outcome of four legal matters he describes as trumped up. He accuses President Vladimir Putin of ordering his attempted murder. Putin has dismissed that. In a push to galvanize support ahead of the protests, Navalny's team released a video this week about an opulent palace on the Black Sea they allege belonged to Putin, something the Kremlin denied. As of Saturday, the clip had been viewed more than 68 million times. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is saying that the new English variant of COVID-19 may be associated with a higher level of mortality, although he said evidence showed that both vaccines being used in the country are effective against it. Johnson said that the impact of the new variant, which is already known to be more transmissible, was putting the health service under intense pressure. This is VOA News, and here are some of the other stories making headlines around the world today. Tropical cyclone Eloise made landfall in Mozambique early on Saturday, hitting the coastal city of Beira with huge gusts of winds and heavy rains, but it was losing strength as it progressed, according to a South African weather official. Portuguese voters, largely confined to their homes due to a strict COVID-19 lockdown, will pick a new president on Sunday, but many fear going to the polls could worsen a surge in coronavirus cases, and low turnout is expected. The country of 10 million people, which fared better than others in the first wave of the pandemic, now has the world's highest 7-day rolling average of new cases and deaths per million people. Three people in hotel quarantine associated with the Australian Open tennis tournament have tested positive for the highly transmissible coronavirus variant linked to the United Kingdom, officials said on Saturday. The three quarantined in Melbourne are not players, said the state agency responsible for quarantining. All have been in hard lockdown since their arrival on January 15th. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister said Saturday the kingdom was optimistic that it would have excellent relations with the new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden and that it would continue to negotiate with Washington regarding the Iran nuclear deal. France's top health advisory body on Saturday recommended doubling the time between people being given the first and second COVID-19 vaccinations to 6 weeks from three in order to increase the number getting inoculated. The gap between the first and second injection in France is currently 3 weeks for people in retirement homes who take priority and 4 weeks for others, such as health workers. Eight Chinese bomber planes and four fighter jets entered the southwestern corner of Taiwan's air defense identification zone on Saturday, and Taiwan's Air Force deployed missiles to monitor the incursion. That's what the island's defense ministry said. China, which claims Taiwan as its own territory, has conducted almost daily flights over the waters between the southern part of Taiwan and the Taiwan-controlled Pratas Islands in the South China Sea in recent months. And Hong Kong's government locked down an area of Kowloon Peninsula on Saturday after an outbreak of the novel coronavirus, saying 10,000 residents must stay home until they've been tested. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada, and our moderator is Dan Revive, columnist for Newsday.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. A new leader here in America, Joseph R. Biden Jr., is now the president of the United States. Donald J. Trump has returned to being a private citizen at his resort and private club in Palm Beach, Florida. Also, Mr. Biden's Democratic Party has captured just barely majority control in the U.S. Senate, and the Democrats already have the majority in the House of Representatives. What do these big changes mean for the months and years ahead? First, let's go back to this past Wednesday. Every 4 years, on January 20th, a president of the United States is sworn in. Joe Biden took the oath of office, pledging to work hard to unite Americans in a country that is politically deeply divided. But some of Mr. Biden's first policy moves are already being condemned by leading Republicans. Mr. Biden, they say, is simply being a liberal or progressive, bringing back Barack Obama's policies, as well as many Obama staffers returning to the U.S. government. Tom DeFrank, first, please speak about Inauguration Day with the tightest security we'd ever seen here in Washington, D.C. 25,000 National Guard soldiers plus thousands of police were on duty. Tom, how did things go?
Well, they went surprisingly well. There was no massive influx of insurrectionists, as some have called them, as peaceful protesters, as they like to call themselves. It reminds me of the Green Zone in Baghdad. At one point, a huge swath of downtown was shut down. 18 subway system stations were closed. The bridges were closed coming into Washington. It would have been very difficult for anybody to make mischief. And thankfully, there was none. I mean, now somebody will surely say maybe it was overkill. But after the events of January 6th, where thousands of people got into the Capitol, the temple of American democracy, and trashed a good part of it, the government wasn't going to take any chances. So far, so good. The inauguration went off without a hitch, Dan.
Tom, it was a relief that there wasn't any violence here in Washington on Inauguration Day itself. And at the ceremony, the former president, the outgoing president, Donald Trump, he wasn't there. A big break in tradition. That hadn't happened for more than 150 years that an outgoing president refused to come to the ceremony that was swearing in his successor. But there were three former presidents there, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and a Republican, George W. Bush. So there was that symbol of unity. Richard Lautendress, as a foreign correspondent here, a Canadian who knows the United States very well, when you put all of that together, no violence, yes, Republicans were there, but not Donald Trump. What did you think about Inauguration Day on the 20th?
Well, it looked and it felt as normal as can be. Tom was underlining the fact that the city was under siege, was the National Guards, thousands of them around, policemen, women. But there's also the reality of the pandemic. We could not bring people in the city. The new administration didn't want people to agglomerate on the mall and be side by side. So it was creating a new reality, a very different reality compared to what we saw during the previous inauguration days when, you know, there was fervor and there was enthusiasm. And I remember well Barack Obama's swearing-in ceremonies. There were people, even people who did not support the new president, who were in town willing to indulge in this new spirit coming with this new administration. This time it was impossible to build this. And still, I had the impression that walking around, the way Joe Biden went, for instance, to mass early in the morning with congressional leaders, he was sworn in normally as 45 presidents before him. The visit to Arlington Cemetery was solemn but normal. You know, that there's a platform that was built just on the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue and Lafayette Square in front of the White House. I have seen Donald Trump and Barack Obama walk in front of us. But in the end, you know, there were military bands and police corps and the band from the University of Delaware, and the President Biden walked in front of us without a crowd, but as normal as can be. So all this to say, to me, they succeeded to organize something with the threat that was in the city after what happened 2 weeks ago and the reality of the pandemic. And it worked out pretty well. That's the impression it left me.
A lot of relief here in Washington that January 20th has come and gone without major upheaval or violence. And yet, you're right, you had the sense that because of COVID-19, that there were never going to be many members of the public involved, but especially after January 6th. As Tom has reminded us, pro-Trump protesters invaded the Capitol building. They tried to stop Congress from confirming the election results. At least 5 deaths were caused by that. And 2 weeks later, in exactly the same location, just outside the Capitol building and inside the building as well, everything was normal and calm. So that was a major relief. But Tom, the anger that we saw on January 6th, it seems to me that a lot of the rumors and misinformation and mistrust still exists in America. Opinion polls indicate that tens of millions of Americans don't think that the election was fair and legitimate. That's not gone, is it, Tom?
No, it's not gone at all, Dan. About a third of the country has questions about the election's legitimacy, but more to the point, more than two-thirds of voters who supported Mr. Trump think the election was rigged and agree with him that it was stolen. That is a breathtaking number. It's ridiculous. It's absurd. But when you have that many Americans believing it, that tells you we have a long way to go here in terms of calming the tones of bringing the country together. Now, President Biden said in his inaugural speech, democracy has prevailed. And I think he was right about that. But bipartisanship is a long way from being a reality. With that many millions of people believing the former president's spurious allegations, there's a lot of polarization and a lot of anger out there. And as long as Republicans don't step up to the plate and say, we have to say this, these claims of a rigged election are bogus. Until Republicans start doing that, I don't think there's any chance to fix the polarization, the extreme polarization in the country.
Richard, as you were covering the start of the new Biden administration on January 20th, what stood out to you? Because I know a lot of correspondents were underlining the vice president, right? The new vice president, Kamala Harris, until recently a senator from the state of California. She's the first female vice president. She's the first person of color, as some people put it, of both African-American heritage and South Asian heritage. There were celebrations in her mother's ancestral town in India. And so Kamala Harris represents a lot, but I think she wanted to show that her focus is getting to work.
Yes, the focus of the vice president is to show that a country can fall on its feet and start running early in a new direction. And you were asking me how it was perceived, for instance, in Canada. We underline the president's speech, this way of introducing and insisting on the fact that the Americans have for the first time a female, a woman as vice president of the United States. And he added, don't tell me this country cannot change. Things cannot change. And the perception in Canada, but I think in several other countries, was that during and after the 4 years of the Trump presidency, there was this impression that, okay, we know how this president is dealing, is managing his thing, a lot of improvisation. It's very hard to figure out how he will manage this issue one day and the day after. Now, things can change in a way that we understand and we can forecast. And I believe this is the way Kamala Harris was seen, but also, by extension, the new orders that are coming, the executive orders signed by President Biden, give us a clearer sense that, okay, what we lived, what we went through during the last 4 years, it's a totally different dynamic, which bring us somewhere else. In Canada, Dan, we, for instance, talking about those executive orders, there was disappointment when we heard that the Keystone Project was abandoned. The Keystone XL Project, which was supposed to bring oil from the tar sands fields in central Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. This said, as much as Prime Minister Justin Trudeau underlined this, he was enthusiastic with This idea of, for instance, rejoining the Climate Paris Accord, rejoining the World Health Organization, the moratorium on oil and natural gas in the Arctic, you know, there are several issues there which, in the spirit of seeing Kamala Harris arriving at the vice presidency, shows that there's something new coming to the United States and to the world with this administration.
Something new and something old all along. That is a return to conventional pre-Trump policies in many ways. We'll be talking more about global reaction a little later, but let's just consider COVID-19 and how the crisis, in fact, is worse than it was in the spring of last year, including here in the U.S. Instead of last year's average of fewer than 2,000 deaths from COVID every day, it's now more than 4,000 people dying of coronavirus each day in this country. And the problems with delivering vaccines are embarrassing. Tom DeFrank, what do you see?
Well, I couldn't agree more, Dan. And there are now stories, and quoting Biden officials, as saying, we have discovered there is no real distribution plan for the vaccine, and there's not enough of it out there. So one of the first executive orders Biden has signed is to enable, under the Defense Production Act, increase and expand production of the vaccine and distribution and delivery of the vaccine. The Trump regime basically said, all right, we have created a vaccine in record time, and distributing it is your problem, not our problem. Well, the Biden people have said, no, it's everybody's problem, and we have to have a more centralized, coordinated plan. So Biden is still hoping that he can get 100 million people vaccinated in the first 100 days of his presidency, which would be roughly the 1st of May. We'll see whether he can do that. But the Biden people are saying the Trump administration talked a lot but didn't do enough. And of course, Biden has ordered the mandatory wearing of masks on all federal property. It can't be mandatory other places. The one of the dirty little not so secret secrets is that millions of Americans are spurning masks, and it's become a political issue. Basically, if you're for Trump, you think masks are a plot or a hoax or something. We have now passed the 400,000 deaths milestone, a dubious milestone indeed. And there are now computer models that say we may lose another 100,000 Americans in the next couple of months unless we do something about masks. So it's really getting worse, not getting better. And it's one of many problems that Biden has to address right away.
More on the coronavirus crisis and worldwide reaction to the change in leadership here in the United States when we continue after this brief break.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Richard Lautendress, correspondent for TVA Nouvelle Canada. And our moderator, Dan Rabib, columnist for Newsday.
Richard, we were just talking about the way the United States is handling the COVID-19 crisis, where things are getting worse. And we hear even from big cities, and maybe especially big cities like New York and Los Angeles, that they are running out of vaccine. There are days in which citizens have an appointment to get their vaccine shot, and then they show up and, I'm sorry, we've run out of vaccine. What are the facts? I mean, how can it be that the manufacturers are not keeping up with demand?
Well, obviously, there's a part of the entire process of distributing this vaccine that's not clear. There were agreements that were signed, and we had the impression from long ago, several months ago, that it was clear as soon as the vaccines were going to be approved, that they were going to be easily accessible, easily or quite easily distributed, and it's not that clear. But it brings, unfortunately, Dan, it brings me back to the before the Biden administration, in the way the whole thing was managed, the will of going fundamentally through states to manage this distribution of vaccine makes it very hard to figure out Where do they come from? Where do they go? Who's going to have them first? And this is why I see, even without criticizing Trump administration again, the simple fact that this new administration, it really makes a priority of fighting the coronavirus. When I was listening to the very first briefing of the new press secretary, Jen Psaki, when she said that Wednesday evening, the day of the inauguration, that the president wants us to lead by example, us being the members of the new White House, this idea that if the Trump administration had shown the same will to lead by example, to show the world that wearing a mask, being organized, is going to get us to results, that would help. So what I mean by this is that there's a signal sent by this new administration that we are going to make sure that every step is going to be built and followed closely. So first, wear mask, keep distance. Okay, now the vaccine. Where are the vaccine? How many do we have? Who gets them? And how is it distributed? There's a will to boost the supply chains, to increase the testing capacities. There's this 100 days masking challenge. So clear moment, clear repère, as we say in French, criteria that have to be respected. And I have the impression that to answer your question after this long introduction, we start from not enough information to clear benchmarks that will have to be respected. And then we will have to figure out, okay, why didn't it happen this time?
Tom, you're an expert, of course, on American government. And I think we have to point out that during a time of transition, the Biden administration doesn't begin with a Secretary of Health and Human Services. There is no clear permanent leadership in many agencies of the U.S. government. And this could hamper a national response to COVID-19 and getting enough vaccines out there.
At the moment, the only cabinet officer confirmed by the U.S. Senate is the Director of National Intelligence. Every other cabinet-level agency is being administered by an acting secretary or an acting administrator. And I think this is because the Republicans have not scheduled appointments for them. Now, I suspect within a week that will change, but at the moment, the orderly transition of power to the agencies has gone slowly. And you're correct. That will slow down the new Biden policies on vaccine dissemination and distribution.
You know, at least when it comes to newspaper editorials around the world, you know, I got the sense, especially I would say in Western Europe, also political leaders, and what they had to say, well, they seem relieved that the 4 years of Donald Trump as president are over, as though having President Joe Biden, a former vice president who was a U.S. senator for more than 30 years, will signal a return to conventional American policies. Some are saying a return to normal. Certainly, the Donald Trump policy of America first is not the Biden policy. Richard, what have you noticed about global reaction?
Global reaction, I've noticed, is one of now we can predict what is coming. We can predict because President Biden has been vice president. When he was a senator, he was chairing the Senate Committee on Foreign Affairs. They've seen him. They know the way he sees the world. He knows the world. It was interesting to read the very last interview of former State Secretary Rex Tillerson about foreign policy, about Donald Trump, underlining the fact that he didn't know the world. He didn't understand the world. Well, Joe Biden knows the world. He knows several of the leaders who are in place at the moment. Then there's Antony Blinken, is nominee for state secretary. He's been close to the president for a long time when he was senator, but he knows the State Department. He knows the world. So the reaction outside of the United States is finally a predictable team. We don't think in Canada that the concept of America first is totally going to disappear, because we know that Joe Biden insists on the buying American, and he repeated it himself, saying, you know, built in America, sold in America, and everything you want to put perspective on the fact that it's going to be an American-centered policy, but with an openness to the world that was not perceived positively in the previous administration, and this simple impression of predictability and of willingness to work on the world stage with the United Nations, with the international organizations, is perceived very positive.
Right from the start, both Wednesday and Thursday, the Biden White House said that the United States will re-enter the Paris Climate Change Accord and will cancel the Trump plan to leave the World Health Organization. The Biden administration will work with the WHO on vaccines all around the world and on trying to fight coronavirus and other diseases. So there may be a measure of relief around the world, but Saudi Arabia may stand out as an exception. The Saudis enjoyed their relations with President Trump. He would emphasize all the American weapons and military aircraft that the U.S. was selling to Saudi Arabia and other Gulf Arab countries. Those countries are waging a war against the Houthi rebels in Yemen. Saudi Arabia claims that the Houthis are basically proxies for Iran, and Donald Trump agreed with that. The Biden administration may have doubts. And on China, well, Donald Trump had turned against China this past year, saying that coronavirus is the China virus. And so he was tough on China when it comes to trade. And also in recent weeks, the Trump administration was condemning human rights abuses in China, something that it had not done. Tom DeFrank, do you have any sense that the Biden administration will be tough on Saudi Arabia and China when it comes to human rights? And that may affect America's place in the world.
Yes, I think that's going to exactly be the case. The Biden administration will be tougher on Saudi Arabia and China on human rights and civil rights. And I think the Chinese will howl about it, and the Saudis will be unhappy about it, but they're going to have to get used to that. That will happen. I wanted to add very quickly to something we've not talked about, Dan, about the changes in Washington. The biggest change, I think, is the tone of governance. Yes, we were a polarized, divided country, but we don't have Donald Trump on Twitter referring to his enemies as losers or jerks or dopes or low IQ. The pejorative nature of the Trump White House and the Trump government has gone away. That doesn't mean it's all smooth sailing. It doesn't mean the Democrats and the Republicans are going to agree on policies going forward, but in terms of just tonalities, there's a better, and I would argue more productive and constructive tone of discourse and dialogue all of a sudden, and we haven't had that in 4 years.
And just to button up our broadcast, Richard, what's your sense of that? Because the Biden administration says it wants the United States to be more united. Unity was one of the very big words for Joe Biden on the day he was inaugurated. What do you think is the outlook? A lot of doubts about uniting this country?
Doubts for sure. There's no magic wand that would improve quickly the state of affairs between Americans. But I believe that Biden's success in controlling the pandemic, of breaking this virus and the spread of the virus and the impression that we're still living away from each other without being able to have a normal life. The success of the new administration on this very point, and add to this, success of restarting the economy, helping businesses, smaller businesses in particular, to go back to something that looks like normal, welcoming customers. Again, the two go side by side. The idea of controlling the virus and improving slowly the economy and the economic activities, this success will bring more unity, more willingness from the opponent to the arrival of Joe Biden going forward and saying, okay, we see the outcome, we see the result, we see that it works out. Why not give this president a chance? Which was what Joe Biden insisted, and I think this is a major thing. Give me a chance, listen to me, let's see how we can do it together. And I believe with some results on these at this level, it will help this unity expectation.
Literally in his first speech as president, Joe Biden did ask Americans to give him a chance. That's all the time we have for this broadcast. Thanks to our panelists, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Richard Latendresse, correspondent for TVA or TVA Nouvelle in Canada. This program is produced by The Voice of America. I'm Dan Ravitch.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Ana Mateo and Jonathan Evans. Later, Armin Kasabian answers a question from an English learner in this week's Ask a Teacher. We close the show with an American story. This week, it is $1,000 by O. Henry. But first,
when day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade?
On Wednesday, poet Amanda Gorman read her poem, The Hill We Climb, at the swearing-in ceremony of President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. By Thursday, the 22-year-old was a superstar. Gorman is the youngest poet in U.S. history to mark the change of presidential power. Past inaugural poets include famous writers like Robert Frost and Maya Angelou. Gorman is a native of Los Angeles, California, and in 2017 was named the country's first youth poet laureate. She recently completed her studies at Harvard University. On Wednesday, Gorman offered a hopeful future for a deeply divided country.
We will not march back to what was, but move to what shall be, a country that is bruised, but whole, benevolent, but bold, fierce, and free.
Her reading, and the ceremony as a whole, took place exactly 2 weeks after a violent mob of supporters of then-President Donald Trump attacked and occupied the U.S. Capitol building. Gorman says she had completed a little more than half of The Hill We Climb before the January 6th attack at the Capitol. That day gave me a second wave of energy to finish the poem, Gorman told the Associated Press. She chose not to make direct note of the attack, but her references to the event were clear.
We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it, would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated.
Hours after the inauguration, her two books, which are to be released later this year, became number 1 and 2 on Amazon.com's sales list. Gorman's poetry collection, The Hill We Climb, and her children's book, Change Sings, are set to be published in September.
Among all the young sumo wrestlers in the circle, 10-year-old Kyuta Kumogai stands out. He weighs 85 kilograms. That means he is 2 times the size of the other children his age. His big size makes him very good at his sport. When he wrestles boys 5 or 6 years older, he wins. He is so good that last year, Kyuta was named the under-10 world champion. He defeated competitors from as far away as Britain and Ukraine. Kyuta is a shy boy of few words. When reporters for the Associated Press asked him why he likes to wrestle, His answer was simple. It is fun to beat people older than me. His father, Taisuke, created his son's training routine. And the training is not easy. The 10-year-old boy trains 6 days each week and does many different exercises. He lifts weights, moves huge tires, swims, and runs. The goal is to build up flexibility and quickness, two things needed for sumo wrestling. Kyuta has been on this routine since about age 6. That is when his father first entered him in a sumo competition. "I didn't teach him anything," Taisuke said, adding that his son could wrestle naturally. Taisuke himself used to be a sumo wrestler. "There is a talent for sumo," he said, "and he has that talent." After winning that first competition, Taisuke thought his son may have a special talent for sumo. The training costs a lot of money and requires sacrifices from the entire family, including his mother, Makiko. His father says he does not gamble. Instead, he is betting everything on his son. When it became clear the boy had talent, Taisuke moved the family to the Fukugawa area of Tokyo. This area is famous for sumo wrestlers. It has many sumo clubs. It also has the Nami no Sukuna Shrine. This is where the god of sumo is said to live. So there is a lot of local support for sumo culture. Father and son use a local temple for intense one-on-one training. The training usually ends with the two wrestling up and down the carpet in front of the main temple. Taisuke pushes Kyuta so hard that the child is often left breathless and crying. But the father believes it is the only way to get the best out of his son. "I think he is managing to make time for himself, and I think he has time to play with his friends," explained Taisuke, adding, "I don't think it is too much pressure." Besides training, another important part of sumo success is food. On an average day, Kyuta will eat up to 4,000 calories. This includes over a liter of milk and a lot of protein. Steak is his favorite. While Kyuta ate a large meal, his father told reporters that his son needs to put on another 20 kilograms by the time he enters middle school in 2 years. If he does that, the hope is he will be taken in by a famous sumo coaching team. Taisuke said there has already been interest. Kyuta himself said he wants to reach the level of Yokozuna. That is the highest ranking in the sport. But he admits the workout routine and lifestyle can be extreme and hard. Sumo training is something you don't describe with words like enjoy, Kyuta said. "When it became tough, I have thought about quitting sometimes." For now, the struggle toward the top continues for both father and son. I'm Anna Mateo.
Giggling bread and joyfully dancing salad are not the usual meals served in Thailand. But one eatery is hoping its foods made with parts of the cannabis plant can interest foreign visitors. The restaurant at a hospital in Prachinburi province started serving the meals this month. Thailand recently took cannabis off its list of narcotic drugs. The government then permitted some businesses to grow the plant. Pakakrang Kwankau is the project leader at the hospital. She told the Reuters news service, cannabis leaves, when put in the food or even a small amount, it will help the patient to recover faster. She added, the cannabis leaf can improve appetite and make people sleep well, and also be in a good mood. The hospital is known as being the first in Thailand to study marijuana and its ability to ease pain and extreme tiredness. Thailand became the first Southeast Asian country to legalize cannabis for medical use in 2017. Since then, many medical marijuana centers have opened across the country. The restaurant's offerings include a happy pork soup and deep-fried bread topped with pork and a marijuana leaf. Another is a mix of crispy cannabis leaves served with pork and vegetables. I've never taken cannabis before. It feels weird, but it's delicious, said Ketsarin Bunsari, one person who ate at the restaurant. Another, Nathano Naranan, said the taste of the cannabis leaves was similar to some other vegetables. But she said the after effects of eating cannabis were very different. Thai Deputy Education Minister Kanakwan Wilawan said the next step was to offer new versions of famous Thai dishes to appeal to people across the world. We plan to add more cannabis to Thai dishes that are already well known, such as green curry soup, to boost the popularity of these dishes even more, Kanakwan said.
This week, we answer a question from Kaya from China. Could you tell me the differences between technology and technique? And how do we use them in our daily life? Thank you. Dear Kaya, thank you for your question. The words technology and technique are different, but they both come from a Greek word meaning the study of an art or craft. Words starting with tech and techno describe a skill, art, or way of doing things. Technique is a way of doing a specific activity. For example, if you study the guitar, you can learn techniques for playing different kinds of music. If you like cooking, you can learn techniques for making foods from around the world. Here is an example.
The soccer players train every day to improve their technique.
Technology is the use of scientific knowledge and methods. Technology makes jobs easier by improving machines and tools. For example,
a camera is now easier to use because of digital technology.
You can use numerous techniques to use the same technology. Here are two examples.
My technique for taking better pictures is to take more pictures of friends for fun. Nabila knows how to use camera technology to take better pictures of her friends.
A telephone is a kind of technology that has changed over time. Techniques for using telephones have also changed.
Over 140 years ago, the phone was a new technology for people to communicate. Now people use new techniques like texting and messaging to communicate over the phone.
And that is Ask a Teacher. I'm Armin Kasabian.
$1,000, said the lawyer Tolman in a severe and serious voice, and here is the money. Young Gillian touched the thin package of $50 bills and laughed. It's such an unusual amount, he explained kindly to the lawyer. If it had been $10,000, a man might celebrate with a lot of fireworks. Even $50 would have been less trouble.
You heard the reading of your uncle's will after he died, continued the lawyer Tolman. I do not know if you paid much attention to its details. I must remind you of one. You are required to provide us with a report of how you use this $1,000 as soon as you have spent it. I trust that you will obey the wishes of your late uncle.
You may depend on it, said the young man respectfully. Gillian went to his club. He searched for a man he called Old Bryson. Old Bryson was a calm, antisocial man, about 40 years old. He was in a corner reading a book. When he saw Gillian coming near, he took a noisy, deep breath, laid down his book, and took off his glasses. I have a funny story to tell you, said Gillian.
I wish you would tell it to someone in the billiard room, said Old Bryson. You know how I hate your stories.
This is a better one than usual, said Gillian, rolling a cigarette, and I'm glad to tell it to you. It's too sad and funny to go with the rattling of billiard balls. I've just come from a meeting with my late uncle's lawyers. He leaves me an even $1,000. Now, what can a man possibly do with $1,000? Old Bryson showed very little interest.
I thought the late Septimus Gillian was worth something like $500,000.
He was, agreed Gillian happily, and that's where the joke comes in. He has left a lot of his money to an organism. That is, part of it goes to the man who invents a new bacillus, and the rest to establish a hospital for doing away with it again. There are one or two small, unimportant gifts on the side. The butler and the housekeeper get a seal ring and $10 each. His nephew gets $1,000.
Were there any others mentioned in your uncle's will? Asked Old Bryson.
None, said Gillian. Well, there is a Miss Hayden. My uncle was responsible for her. She lived in his house. She's a quiet thing, musical, the daughter of somebody who was unlucky enough to be his friend. I forgot to say that she was in on the ring and $10 joke, too. I wish I had been. Then I could have had two bottles of wine, given the ring to the waiter, and had the whole business off my hands. Now tell me what a man can do with $1,000. Old Bryson rubbed his glasses and smiled. And when Old Bryson smiled, Gillian knew that he intended to be more offensive than ever.
There are many good things a man could do with $1,000, said Bryson. You
he said with a gentle laugh. Why, Bobby Gilliam, there's only one reasonable thing you could do. You can go and buy Miss Lotta Laurier a diamond necklace with the money. And then take yourself off to Idaho and inflict your presence upon a ranch. I advise a sheep ranch, as I have a particular dislike for sheep. Thanks, said Gillian, as he rose from his chair. I knew I could depend on you, old Bryson. You've hit on the very idea. I wanted to spend the money on one thing, because I have to turn in a report for it, and I hate itemizing. Gillian phoned for a cab and said to the driver, the stage entrance of the Columbine Theater. The theater was crowded. Miss Lotta Laurier was preparing for her performance when her assistant spoke the name of Mr. Gillian. Let it in, said Miss Laurier. Now, what is it, Bobby? I'm going on stage in 2 minutes. It won't take 2 minutes for me. What do you say to a little thing in the jewelry line? I can spend $1,000. Say, Bobby, said Miss Laurier, did you see that necklace Della Stacy had on the other night? It cost $2,200 at Tiffany's. Miss Laurier was called to the stage for her performance. Gillian slowly walked out to where his cab was waiting. What would you do with $1,000 if you had it? He asked the driver. Open a drinking place, said the driver quickly. I know a place I could take money in with both hands. I've got it worked out, if you were thinking of putting up the money. Oh, no, said Gillian. I was just wondering. 8 blocks down Broadway, Gillian got out of the cab. A blind man sat on the sidewalk selling pencils. Gillian went out and stood in front of him. Excuse me, but would you mind telling me what you would do if you had $1,000? Asked Gillian. The blind man took a small book from his coat pocket and held it out. Gillian opened it and saw that it was a bank deposit book. It showed that the blind man had a balance of $1,785 in his bank account. Gillian returned the bank book and got back into the cab. I forgot something, he said. You may drive to the law offices of Tolman and Sharp. Lawyer Tolman looked at Gillian in a hostile and questioning way. I beg your pardon, said Gillian cheerfully, but was Miss Hayden left anything by my uncle's will in addition to the ring and the $10? Nothing, said Mr. Tolman. I thank you very much, sir, said Gillian, and went to his cab. He gave the driver the address of his late uncle's home. Miss Hayden was writing letters in the library. The small, thin woman wore black clothes, but you would have noticed her eyes. Gillian entered the room as if the world were unimportant. I have just come from old Tolman's, he explained. They have been going over the papers down there. They found a... Gillian searched his memory for a legal term. They found an amendment or a postscript or something to the will. It seemed that my uncle had second thoughts and willed you $1,000. Tolman asked me to bring you the money. Here it is. Gillian laid the money beside her hand on the desk. Miss Hayden turned white. Oh, she said, and again, Oh. Yillian half turned and looked out the window. In a low voice, he said, I suppose, of course, that you know I love you. I am sorry, said Miss Hayden, as she picked up her money. There is no use, asked Yillian, almost lightheartedly. I am sorry, she said again. May I write a note? Asked Yillian with a smile. Miss Hayden supplied him with paper and pen, and then went back to her writing table. Yillian wrote a report of how he spent the $1,000. Paid by Robert Yillian, $1,000 on account of the eternal happiness owed by heaven to the best and dearest woman on earth. Yillian put the note into an envelope. He bowed to Miss Hayden and left. His cab stopped again at the offices of Tolman and Sharp. I have spent the $1,000, he said cheerfully to Tolman, and I have come to present a report of it as I agreed. He threw a white envelope on the lawyer's table. Without touching the envelope, Mr. Tolman went to a door and called his partner, Sharp. Together, they searched for something in a large safe. They brought out a big envelope sealed with wax. As they opened the envelope, they shook their heads together over its contents. Then Tolman became the spokesman.
Mr. Yillian, he said, there was an addition to your uncle's will. It was given to us privately, with instructions that it not be opened until you had provided us with a full report of your handling of the $1,000 received in the will. As you have satisfied the conditions, my partner and I have read the addition. I will explain to you the spirit of its contents. In the event that your use of the $1,000 shows that you possess any of the qualifications that deserve reward, you stand to gain much more. If your disposal of the money in question has been sensible, wise, or unselfish, it is in our power to give you bonds to the value of $50,000. But if you have used this money in a wasteful, foolish way, as you have in the past, the $50,000 is to be paid to Miriam Hayden, ward of the late Mr. Yillian, without delay. Now, Mr. Yillian, Mr. Sharp and I will examine your report of the $1,000. Mr. Tolman reached for the envelope. Yillian was a little quicker in taking it up. He calmly tore the report and its cover into pieces and dropped them into his pocket. It's all right, he said smilingly. There isn't a bit of need to bother you with this. I don't suppose you would understand these itemized bets anyway. I lost the $1,000 on the races. Good day to you, gentlemen. Tolman and Sharp shook their heads mournfully at each other when Yillian left. They heard him whistling happily in the hallway as he waited for the elevator.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.